Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Wednesday edition. Today's date is September 7th, 2011. And, of course, my name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It's great to have you all here for another important broadcast. I have not done a broadcast of the French Connection in a few weeks. It's actually 2.5 weeks. But I have been continuing to do broadcasts on other networks. I've done a few in South Africa, and I've had a couple of others that have been offered to me. And I've done them because... Essentially, people are starting to come around to the idea that there might be a cabal, and that cabal happens to be from a certain group, and there may be elements within that group that need to be exposed. And a couple of the shows I've done were very I wouldn't say frigid or cold toward the information, but they weren't terribly warm about it either. And so there's a learning curve, and I remember my first response to learning this stuff some 6 years ago. I had a reaction. It was almost a visceral stomach reaction of disgust when I heard that there might be a group of people from a certain religion that are involved in these crimes, and that I had to actually confront my own feelings about it. We've been brainwashed, ladies and gentlemen. We've been peppered and bombarded over the last 50 years since the end of World War II with propaganda, and that propaganda has bored its way deep into our psyches, and there is an undoing that needs to be done within our own selves in order to be receptive to the facts. And those facts can be gleaned by reading, by document reading, by understanding exactly what's going on. Now, my guest today, a dear friend, a wonderful friend, somebody who has gone down the road in her own right, and learned a lot of these facts on her own, and probably, I'm going to ask her in a minute, but it probably had some of the same responses I did, but she's gotten past that and begun to do some extraordinary work. Her book that is out there is called AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire. I'm going to ask her how it's doing in the sales department, but I know everyone who's read it has been shocked and in awe of Nancy's qualities in her writing and her presentation and the documentation that was involved in the book. So, let me bring her up right now. Nancy, are you with me?
Good morning, Daryl, or good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm here.
Well,
from Mexico.
Yes, we are, and this, the quality of this broadcast may not be perfect. We're doing this over phone lines, and I have been having phone line problems here in France. I don't know if what the reasons are for that. But the fact is, as long as people can hear the information, I think we should be fine, Nancy.
I think you know, sometimes technology drives. It's crazy, but it's amazing to think that you could be in France and I could be in Mexico and we could even have this quality of conversation.
Well, I remember some years ago when I first started doing this, I was getting 500 and 600 euro and 700 euro a month phone bills, because at the time when I began my research projects 8 years ago, France did not have cheap phone calling outside the country, and I was getting these massive bills. But you know, now we're in a situation where technology is affording us quicker and easier communication. Here's the thing, Nancy. When you first looked into these accusations, and I'm sure some of it came from my site, when you, about 6 years or 5 years ago, when you started looking, you went, this guy must be daffy. I mean, he must be a whack. And then you started seeing, and you said, well, geez, this looks like there's some truth here. What was your genesis to this truth?
Well, the thing I wrote my book, AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire, and the reason I wrote the book is because of my disquiet about what people were saying about the HIV and AIDS controversy. From a medical standpoint, from an epidemiological standpoint, it simply didn't make sense to me, and so I started looking into this particular disease. But what I discovered in the process of looking at it is that you start going down this rabbit hole, and you start going down the rabbit hole of history, and you and I had to look to see what happened to Western medicine, how did it develop the way it's developed, and who took it over, and how it got taken over. So that led me back to the early part of the 20th century, to the Rockefellers, who were like the Morgans, financed by the Rothschilds of Europe.
Yep.
And how they basically took over the healthcare system, and how the healthcare system or the medical system was tied into the chemical, international chemical industry system. And that tied into the eugenics philosophy, and that tied into the financing of Hitler and the Second World War, and the banks, the international banks, the Federal Reserve. So what I began to do is to see that there was a nexus of connectivity between all of these high-level people who really were not capitalists, who were really monopolists.
Yeah. Well, what was your response in a kind of an emotional way? Because I remember speaking to my wife and saying, "My goodness, I feel sick to my stomach. I actually became a bit depressed from figuring out that, you know, many of the people I went to school with at New York University were from the Jewish community, and I don't remember ever having any particular problem with anybody, and my neighbors were from the Jewish community. So I had to say to myself, holy smokes here, if this is actually coming from the Jewish community, there's a disconnect between my experience with many of the people from that community and what I'm witnessing. Now, I'm sure as a doctor, you had some colleagues and friends from the community that, you know,
yeah, but at higher levels, it's not only Jews, because, you know, the Jews are a minority. So the question is, you have to look to, I really went back to 1290, because you have to understand why. I think it was Edward II expelled,
Edward the First, yeah.
Yeah, expelled the Jews from England. And it was around the same time as the Magna Carta was being developed. So the history goes back to that date. But these people were very, they have intergenerational ideas about how they want to do things. And 350 years later, they found Cromwell and got back into England. So if you look at the history of the banking system in the West, and you see how the banking system has interacted with the elites of the Christianized West, then you have to understand how this power has projected itself through the history of Western civilization.
I agree. Now, here's what I find, and I find that these people, not only were they from an Ashkenazi Jewish background in the leadership, but they decided to take, to leverage their own community and use a very powerful, I would say, brainwashing that went on that community throughout the last 400 years to make sure that that community stayed as a cohesive group that would do their bidding for them. Now, I've had experience trying to explain this to people I know are good-hearted, and they happen to be Jewish, and they flatly refuse to go anywhere near this information. And it's not because they're not honest people. It's because they can't get past the difficulty it is in looking at it.
Well, I think that's pretty much true of the population as a whole. For example, recently I've been, I'm fascinated with how we ignore historical truth.
Yes.
And I was recently listening to a lecture by Anthony Sutton, who was a scholar from the Hoover Institute.
Yes.
And I think that his research is probably impeccable. And once he started doing this research, I think he was asked to leave the Hoover Institute. But basically, one of the things that he acknowledged was how the same group of people were financing Roosevelt, were financing the Bolsheviks, and were financing Hitler simultaneously. That the development of Russia came out of Wall Street. And for those of us who grew up as baby boomers, we found that pretty difficult to understand because our whole life was about being anti-communist.
Yes.
At the same time, the Russians were receiving technical help from our major corporations, from Ford, from GE, from Caterpillar, from ITT. So what was that about? At the time we were financing the Vietnam War, the technology and the weapons were coming from both Russia and the Communist China. But those weapons had been developed here in the West, and the technology had been transferred to them by these very high-level people. So I think the history is written, of course, by the people who have the control at this level. And there are three levels to it. The first level is what the establishment wants people to know, and that's what we see on television or in the newspapers. And that's what most people believe.
Yeah.
But there's a second level, a revisionist level, that I think the gatekeepers get, what we call the gatekeepers, get to this point. But there's a third level, which is based on documentation, which is some of what you've been doing over the years, looking at the documents, looking at the original documents, and seeing who was doing what and how they were doing it. And that's the deep part that most people don't get to, and if they get to it, they have a very difficult time believing it, Daryl.
Well, not only did I have trouble believing it, but once I did sign on to the truth of it and believe it, I found myself being marginalized by people around me in a very a frightening way in some instances, and even had threats made, and in other words, and I wasn't alone in doing this, although I was one of the first in this newest wave of people to bring this forward. You have to actually commit yourself to standing up and going wherever the information leads you. And
one of the things that we're seeing, in whether it's medicine or science or politics, that we're it's really becoming so, it should be obvious to so many people right now, the control, for me personally, which is very sad, is the control with science, how science is being used and manipulated, not to help people but to control them at every level.
Yep.
Whether it's the whole global warming fiasco is an absurdity. The whole vaccine fiasco is an absurdity. This HIV/AIDS thing is an absurdity. The cholesterol business is an absurdity. And the more you look at each of these ideas, you realize that at the top there's a force who is bent on making money no matter what. It doesn't, the science is not the important thing, but creating a belief in people's minds in order to sell their products is what is important.
Well, Nancy, let's talk a little bit here. Now, I want to do not even a big segue, it's a small segue. You and I grew up in an era where I remember that my primary reader in school was Dick, Jane, and Sally, and Spot. Now, you probably read the same books, Dick and Jane and Sally. Now, I got a good math background as a young kid. I got a good reading background. And then, through my education, I actually went on to a Scholastic Jesuit high school where they taught me actually how to think. They're not teaching kids this method of learning any longer, and the idea of a broad-based man of letters, or a Renaissance man, as if you will, is gone out the window. And that Renaissance man, I'm using that term as a way of talking about how people are taught to think. I was taught to think. I was taught to think critically of things and not accept things at face value. That is not what's happening today. And so we're finding out that the next generation doesn't have that same approach to their understanding.
Well, part of what I also looked at was how these same people took over the education system.
Yes.
And so if you want to begin to take over people that have an idea of freedom and free enterprise, and have an idea of democracy, and have an idea that they want to be self-sufficient, then you have to begin to change that. And the way you change it, of course, is through the children and through the education system. So what you see is several things happening simultaneously. You see the quality of the education and the dumbing down of the children. You see the forced drugging of children. So many of our children are on psychotropic drugs.
Yep.
And the reason they are is because they have increased the number of vaccines that the children are taking, and the vaccines can have an inflammatory reaction on the central nervous system, and really seems to be directly related to the rising rate of such things as autism, attention deficit disorder, diabetes, and other kinds of allergies. For example, peanut allergy. When we were growing up, who ever heard of a peanut allergy?
Nobody.
Some of the vaccines, they started putting peanut oil as an adjuvant. And so now we have lots of kids who are allergic to peanuts. So the children are, our children, and the other thing that they've done recently is to promote the cell phone issue and, of course, the electronic games, which I love electronics, but the type of pulsation that you get from cell telephones and towers, it's like putting your head into a microwave.
Yeah.
And so we subject our children to all of that, and then we put them in schools that are dumbing down the curriculum. And what do you expect? It's almost as if we're sacrificing our children on the altar of the money god.
Well, you know, here's the other thing, too, about the destruction of the family that went along in parallel to that. And I've talked to you in the past about the African-American community back in the 50s. Most of the families, like most of the white families, had a father and a mother in the home. And while the socioeconomic level was not always or nearly the same in many instances, at least the nuclear family and the kind of support systems that were involved for young children and for families were present in more often than not. Now today, we see a rise in the destruction of families that has not only decimated both the Latino and the black community, but they've also now come full circle, and the white community is every bit as much destroyed too. So that was a parallel exercise on their part to destroy the cohesion between generations, between parents, between mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, and that has all gone along in parallel to the destruction of education.
Well, certainly in the United States, the family unit has been weakening over time. Also, the idea, unfortunately, one of the things, I think that we never really talk about the role of the female energy and the role of the male energy in establishing a unity, because you need both of those energies. And in the West, or everywhere, the female role has always been a little more passive. And that the reason is because the female has had to be responsible for raising the children and passing on the culture of the community. That's basically what, and part of the way she does that is through the home and through the food. There's nothing wrong with that. But somehow the younger women have been made to think that there's something wrong with being the cultural bearers of your community, to be able to pass on the stories, the history, the way in which your culture does things. You do that in the home. You do that through food, through holidays, through festivities. And those are the things often, most often, that are controlled by women. Obviously, the male has a part in that, but traditionally the male has a different role, and the male's role has been more of a protector than a provider. And so sometimes the male has to do the female role and the female has to do the male role. That's the way families stay together, because sometimes there are role reversals. But what happened is that there was a concerted effort during the so-called women's lib movement to denigrate the woman's role and to make it seem as if somehow that was an...
Bella Abzug and Gloria Steinem for a moment, and the same group that we've talked about here, this Zionist ideal that has come into the society, they actually promoted within that movement the destruction of the family through the idea that women's roles shouldn't be that bearer of culture.
Well, it's interesting. I met Aaron Russo. Aaron Russo was a libertarian. He was a promoter. He made the film America from Freedom to Fascism.
Yeah.
And he also did the film Trading Places, which I saw in Spanish last night on television. It's really kind of an interesting movie. But Aaron said he was familiar with Nick Rockefeller, and Nick Rockefeller basically said to him that they had promoted the Women's Lib movement because it was a way of changing the dynamic of the family, and also if mostly men were working, you only had that base of income to charge income tax against. And if you got the women out of the home, you, A, had access to the children when they were younger, and therefore you could control how they thought and developed, and B, you could have more people that you could charge income tax to. So it was sort of like a double kind of whammy to the family.
Yeah, well, you know, here's the thing where we're at now. The moral compass of most people in the West has fallen so far. Now, you know, but let's talk a minute about pornography.
Before we get to that, I also want to say this, because a lot of people say that a lot of women wanted to go to, and I'm a professional woman, so I think that those women but I also had a family, and I also took care of my family. I never thought that, you know, cooking dinner for my ex-husband and my stepchildren was beneath me, and neither did most of the people that I knew who were professional women. But the other issue with that is that we have to be able to support people so that they could be the best that they can. And unfortunately, that what the people who are watching things find weaknesses, and they undermine those weaknesses. And I think we have to be aware of our own role in these kinds of situations, Daryl.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. And I was moving on to that other subject, because I think what happened was, once the family oversight was eroded and people's religious faiths were utterly destroyed, and you can see the Catholic religion getting attacked through the priesthood being homosexual and so forth. Once you move out of a decent moral compass and a community-based mindset, you move into the ability to harvest almost any behavior you wish to instill. And that harvesting of that behavior is kind of molded and morphed as they need it. And this latest one here is having basically turning the society into sociopaths, or if not sociopaths, psychopaths in some ways, where it no longer is thought of. I'll give you an example. I used to watch Friends when it came on television about 15 years ago, and I remember being outraged by the idea that they would promote pornography on Friends, which they did. You know, Joey watching it and saying, "Oh, isn't that wonderful? We get free porn on TV," and blah blah blah. And I remember thinking to myself, "What is it? What are they talking about here?" Well, today that is not considered a bizarre thing to see on TV. In fact, we've gone so far now that people actually wouldn't even give it a second thought. In other words, we have inched our way down to a moral compass that no longer functions.
Yeah, there is no longer a moral compass. I remember maybe about 10 years ago. Well, first of all, let's go back a little while, obviously, to the 50s, 60s, and even 70s. There was a moral compass, and certainly the programs that came on television during family time were programs that the family could watch together. If anything came on that was a little more controversial, it came on much later. But about 10 years ago, I was watching television at some friend's house, and I was appalled, because somehow there had been this transition, and Family Hour was promoting things that they were promoting sexuality, and they were promoting crime, and they were promoting all kinds of things that never would have stood the test of time. And I think it's very difficult right now for people who are raising children to be able to to have a moral compass, because almost everything that you see with your children, you have to spend about an hour explaining the nature of it. I have a little grandniece that she's 13 now, but I used to take her when she was younger to the movies. And after we left the kiddie movies, I spent an hour at lunch explaining to her what the bad things in the movie were, so that she just didn't come away from it totally impressed by these movies.
Yeah.
It's very difficult today to raise children, Daryl.
Yes, I know, and the truth of the matter is, one of the problems that we're all facing today is that we've got a generation of young people that I was already getting problems in my upbringing, because I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s, and we were rebelling. Clearly, things were about LSD and problems in the schools and fighting in the streets, and there were things happening already that were degrading our ability to cohese around a good idea within the community. So I saw that firsthand, but it hadn't gone 100% yet. We were only being victimized at that time. Kids today have all gone all the way down that road, and how is it that we even communicate with them in this present environment? That's the frightful thing.
Well, I think one of the things that I've been looking at, again, is to get back to the science and to look at how the science has been altered in a way that hides knowledge from us. I think we need to... one of the things that it's been clear to me is that the science has been designed in order for us to deny the highest part of ourselves as humans. And that is part of what is happening to children. For example, one of the things that I learned when I was writing my book is that the human being is actually, we function at the quantum physics level. And I'll get into that a little bit later. But we also have electrical energy. All of our cells have a magnetic field. They have across the membranes, they have an electric current. And what happens when you alter the normal electric current in a human being? For example, what happens when you put a baby human being in an electromagnetic field like Wi-Fi? What happens when you give them aluminum and lead in their vaccines? What happens when you give them fluoride in their water to drink? What happens when you give them genetically modified food? So as a scientist, one of the things that I have become aware of is that almost all of the technology that's being introduced, and certainly the number of vaccines, much of it is designed to keep the human not being completely human. It's keeping us from our natural state in which we are able to sense danger and understand when things are not the best for us. So if you're giving people all of these toxins, then it's going to be difficult for them to have a moral compass. Does that make sense, Daryl?
It certainly does, Nancy, and I have seen the level of the robustness of the youth around me that I see, and I have young people. They're French, but they're young people around me, and I see a lack of robustness in their attitudes, in their responses. I also see a feminization of the male side to a detriment. In other words, it's not just a slight change. It's not a behavioral change. It's actually a morphing of their physicality even. So yes, I'm watching in my own generation, people are transforming into something quite different than the human being I was growing up and people around me were.
Well, I didn't write about it extensively in my first book, but what I'm working on right now with the second one is to look at how the introduction of all of this technology is really actually altering the human being to become something other than a human being. And that's basically, and see, this is the thing that I think is quite fascinating, because at the highest level, for example, in Europe, there's an area where they do physics research called CERN.
Yes.
I think it's on the border of Switzerland and France.
Yes, that's right.
They're doing some phenomenal research, but what happens when they make discoveries is that if these discoveries have a way of making the human condition better, somehow they begin to disparage them. For example, recently there's been a re-examination of nuclear fusion, and there's been a group in Italy that has successfully done nuclear fusion again. Now, you remember maybe about 15 years ago there were some Americans that said they did it, and they immediately started disparaging that and took it off the market and took it out of people's ideas. So why is that? Because nuclear fusion has something to do with the nature of the universe, and it has to do with the nature of the fact that there is unlimited energy in the universe. So if we were able to tap this unlimited energy, we wouldn't need these overseers who are fighting wars for oil, would we?
No.
So, but we can't have that seep into our consciousness, because if we thought about the freedom to have unlimited energy and that it's available to us, and it has been, and the idea has been available to us since Nikola Tesla over 100 years ago, but we can't think about that. We have to immediately, the theme has changed, the science is discredited, and maybe these scientists disappear.
Yes.
So in the meantime, they take a wonderful idea, they bury the idea, and then we're all talking about solar panels and wind power and things that ultimately are not going to work.
Well, and if they do work, I'll give you a good example. Shell Oil here in Europe is the number one builder of wind turbines, and of course they're involved in wind farms. So they, in other words, the same companies that are dispensing the oil have moved into these other areas. BP Amoco is involved in solar cell manufacturing, and so they
exactly. But Darryl, think about what would the world be like if energy was practically free.
Well, again, what would happen is that instead of me having to worry about getting a fill-up on my car, I could plug it in, and instead of worrying about having heat in the wintertime and having to go out and chop wood down, I could just flick a switch and have heat, and all of these things would free me to do all kinds of other remarkable things that would make my life a lot easier and free me. It would free me up to start addressing other issues that I might want to address. Now, that could be art, that could be music, it could be whatever it is, but I would have the freedom to do that. We're not free because we're shackled by the need to pay these bills for oil, for gas, for heat, for all of these things, and that's why we go out and trudge our work a day in order to make sure we can keep up to all these nonsenses that these
people... And also think about it, because now the way the society is structured, it's that they always talk about you have to grow, but the only reason you have to grow now is to keep up with the banking system and the usury that you're never going to keep up with anyway, because
right.
It's a giant Ponzi scheme. But think about it. You now have free energy. So this idea that you have to grow all the time would be an absurd idea. And so what the kind of life that societies would have would be the kind of lives where people could create and think and advance in a natural way.
Well, Nancy?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, we've been having a little bit of connection problems on my side, but it might be me, actually. You're exactly right, and here's one of the things. This is part of what I've wanted to talk about, and you mentioned to me the other day, start talking about directions of solutions. We've done a good job of encapsulating the idea that there is a criminal gang out there wanting to siphon off our lives, our efforts. But we also are human beings that need to come out of the fog bank. And once we are able to clear our minds, at least to a level, we can start coming up with solutions for ourselves.
This is what I think is beautiful, Daryl, because I think we're at the point right now where we see that they're forcing a collapse. The reason they're forcing a collapse because the next level is to have this you know, one economic, you know, the worse it gets, and then they keep coming up with ideas to make it even worse. But I think this collapse is not going to work for them. But the problem that I'm having is that people are looking at the collapse, but they're not looking at the future, and I think we need to start looking at the future. But at the base of this, and I think that you've done it well with some of the people that you've had on your show, is to talk about the financial system and what kind of financial system we need going forward. And certainly it's a financial system that doesn't incorporate usury in its paradigm.
I agree with you, because everything needs lubrication, okay, or it doesn't function. The friction of life will stop you from moving if you don't lubricate it somehow. Now, the financial system needs some sort of lubricant to keep things going. However, the system as it stands right now is tilted in the direction, one direction only, and it's never in the direction of the people who need the help. And here we are with the example of North Dakota, where the profits made in that community's bank, which is the bank that is the number one bank in the state of North Dakota, every year it posts a sizable profit. But here's what happens to that profit. It goes back to the residents of North Dakota. So if you live in that state, you're part owner of the bank. And so whatever fees and charges that you pay for the loans you get are returned to you either in roadway systems or in some sort of process that is going to benefit your life. And this is
right.
This is
exactly, and that's what a banking system should be about. The banking system should never be held as a private entity benefiting a few people. A banking institution is a public asset.
That's right. That's right, Nancy, exactly. But do you remember, as kids, I remember my electric company in my area was a public company.
And all the utilities were public, and they always seemed to work. The telephone always worked. The lights always worked.
Always worked. And
very inexpensive.
That's right. Everything always functioned quite well. And now, when they privatized everything, it goes into the pockets of the same people. And if you look at preferred stock ownership in many...
Let me say this to you, and this was part of the Reagan Revolution. I know people amazingly love Ronald Reagan, but part of what they did was to start... the idea that government couldn't function. But there were many things that the government was doing that was functioning at a very high level.
Yes. Yes.
Because they were done as a public trust.
Yes.
And I think we have forgotten. Because anything that's done as a public trust, they start saying it's socialism. But some things have to be done as a public trust.
Well,
I don't think everything can be privatized.
No, but now that we're privatizing education, we're privatizing prisons, we're privatizing water systems, we're privatizing roadways, and of course, you start going down the names of the companies involved, Veolia and Serco and all this, it goes right back.
Well, because
back.
If you privatize, again, that becomes no longer the asset of the people who actually paid for the asset. And see, this is the craziness. The people, through their taxes, pay for the asset, and then that asset is privatized, which means they sell the asset from under the people, and then the people have to pay a private corporation for an asset that they've already paid for.
That's right. That's right. Well, it's the same thing with your home now, because, I mean, your family, it used to be generationally you would pass a home on to elements within that family and so forth. Today, everybody has to go and return to the bank every generation and repay for the home they already bought.
Well, that's the other thing. For example, why should a bank be allowed to charge you for three houses that you only live in one generation?
Well, that's right.
By the time you paid for a house, by the time you paid the money back, you've paid for three houses.
That's right. And then the next generation starts it over again, and they pay three times more.
So that is the bank should not be allowed, if a bank again is a public trust, the bank is not doing anything more than manipulating numbers. They're basically number pushers. And why banks should be allowed to have so many assets based on charging you interest on money that they never lent you in the first place, which means that you essentially are a slave to the banking system. And I think people don't, it's really very difficult for people to understand how, in fact, we are slaves to the banking system and that we spend most of our lives working in order to work for the banking system.
Well, Nancy, but we're also working in the banking system in indirect ways that are directly affecting everybody. And I'll give you a quick example. Back in 1580, 1620, in that area, when it used to be that the governments themselves, even the kings and queens here in Europe, would finance their own wars. They were robber barons in their own right, but they were financing them. As soon as Rothschild popped his head up and figured out that his biggest clients should not be individuals, but rather countries and governments, that's when the real fireworks happened. And once he figured out that he could indebt a nation and cause that nation's taxes and future taxes to be paid back to him, that's when real slavery started rearing its head. And so not only in the private banking side, where we now have credit cards and the rest of it, we're indebted through our taxation to these bankers as well. So in every instance, whether directly or indirectly, we're being fleeced in a way that we don't even see it by looking at it in a kind of opaque way. We're not really seeing that this is all going back to the same people, even if it's government.
Well, what the banking system has done, it's enabled a small number of people to control the rest of us from the shadows. And I think it's a very clever system. It's, as you say, it's opaque. There is, I think Plato in his Republic wrote a story about, I can't remember the shepherd's name. It was Lysages or something. He was a shepherd. He was a simple shepherd, and he was in the field tending his flocks. And there was a storm, and all of a sudden there was an opening in the ground, and there was a cave. And he went into this cave, and there was this horse, and inside of the horse was a man who had died, and on his finger was a ring. And so Gyges, I think was his name, Gyges took the ring from the cave and went back to the shepherds. And as he was playing with the ring, he discovered, as they were talking about who was going to the king to report on the sheep, he discovered that he could become invisible. And this was something that was very wonderful. So because he intended not to use it in a positive way. So he got himself elected as the shepherd that would go to the king to report on the nature of his flock. But when he got to the palace, he used the power of the ring to seduce the king's wife and kill the king and become the king. Basically, the story is about how you take power by staying in the shadows. And I think that's like when you say, after you discovered what was going on and I discovered what was going on, I think you become overwhelmed and appalled because you realize the nature of how power is really manipulated from the shadows.
Do you believe the people committing these crimes are as depraved as their actions?
Well, they're psychopaths, and psychopaths, I mean, you know, on television they make you think psychopaths are just, you know, the people who are serial killers and that sort of thing. But Wall Street is full of psychopaths, and basically they're, for example, the presidents of the United States are psychopaths. George Bush, after the attack on Iraq, they had this dinner where they, with the press club and the politicians.
Yeah.
And he was making a joke. He was looking under the table for the weapons of mass destruction. He was laughing. Ha, ha, ha. No weapons of mass destruction under here. And so that's a psychopath. A psychopath is totally unaware or unconcerned about the carnage that he wreaks in the world. Totally. And not only that, he's making fun of the people who believed his lies. He was making fun of the American people, and he was making fun of the deaths of the Iraqis, the thousands of untold thousands, perhaps millions of people who have died because of his lies. That's a psychopath. Yet we admire these people because we think that they have temporal power. But that's the weakness in us.
Now, is this, that's the question I was going to ask. Is this an acculturation process that makes us psychopathic, or do you believe people now are automatically going to be raised as psychopaths in this present condition? I believe we are raising psychopaths as a matter of course rather than as a unique. In other words, we're not seeing it as a rarity anymore, but rather as the norm.
Well, I think the psychopaths always have become in the system that we have, the people who have controlled things for a long time have shown psychopathic behavior. You certainly can look at it through the kings and queens of Europe, through the people who are the heads of corporations, because the choices that they make don't elevate humanity, they actually denigrate humanity.
Nancy, do you remember when you were doing your MBA studies, and I'm sure during this
but period... I want to finish...
Okay, go ahead, go.
Before I go on. So at that level, we've become immune to, and we've learned to admire these psychopaths because they're often rich and powerful, and sometimes they're glamorous. So that's one level. But what is happening, as you said now, is that, for example, we see the police acting like psychopaths. We see the police totally ignoring the Constitution and becoming militarized and beating people, using tasers. They're using handcuffs on 6-year-olds and tasering people in wheelchairs. That's absolutely, it's criminal behavior. So that part is being learned. So there are two levels of it, Darryl. I think there's a group of people who are born psychopaths, and there's another group that we are teaching to be psychopaths.
Well, you know, learning about, I remember when I was studying, especially in the profession that I was working in after I left the kitchen, for finance and business, of course, everyone read the books Machiavelli, and they read the book Sun Tzu, and both of those books talk about learning how to be an effective psychopath. And of course, they were lauded as the right way to approach business. And this is what people. I mean, if you hadn't read Sun Tzu as a business student, then you were a weirdo. And of course, I read it more than 5 times. The point of the matter is what I'm trying to say here is that it was lauded as the proper means of interaction in these professions.
Absolutely, but remember the Masters in Business Administration was something that was also developed by these people who wanted to begin to develop a coterie of people who would think the way they did. Because,
yes.
For example, many of the people before the MBAs were developed who were promoted in the factories or the businesses were the people who came out of the, who were the workers on the floor.
That's right.
They knew the people there in the business, they knew the business, and they were concerned about making the business successful. But they also had a passion and a compassion for the people that they worked with because they lived in the community. So now you have a group of people who don't live in the community, who are above being compassionate about the people that they work with, and learn how to look at the numbers, and that's all they look at. And then you have a government who says the role of the corporation is to make money. So how do you square that with a society where you want to have people with humanity? Well, you can't, because the two don't logically fit together.
That's right. And you know, the idea of professional business education came out of Harvard and out of Penn. And, of course, Wharton and Harvard were the front runners of that. And if you take a look at who was designing those programs, You'll find out we go right back to the same CFR, which was a Rothschild construct from the round table, and we start looking at where they were getting their cadre from, and it was coming out of this class of management. And of course, now that this is ubiquitous, we have this style of thinking in every educational process. And so now it has become ingrained in us to have these ways of doing business. We are, and even if we wanted to reverse course now, Nancy, we have to do it from the grassroots, from people who don't have maybe the pollution in their heads. I don't know. You know, here's one of the things that I learned over the last few years. The more I have, the more I worry about what I have. The less I have, the less I worry about what I have. And worrying doesn't seem to be a good state of affairs for anybody. And the idea is that for me to go out in my life and spend my whole life trying to garner and gain in some physical sense, and not talk about the life as a totality, rather how much I can acquire. This is what we've turned ourselves into at the leadership level. And so
this gets back to the story of the Ring of Gaijin, because the question is, how do you begin to change a moral society into an immoral society? And there are these little quiet things that get put into place that we ignore at our own peril. For example, who said, and how did it become ingrained in the business community, that the only thing you have to make sure of is that you make a profit? How did that become the only thing that a business person has to look out for? Because then that's all you have to worry about, then it doesn't matter how you make the profit. It doesn't matter if you pollute the environment, because that is a cost that won't be your cost. It will be offset by the people who you're polluting. So that's the deal. You have to look at to see how these ideas began to be introduced into the society, because businesses didn't always operate that way. They also had an obligation to the society, to the community in which they lived.
That's right. You're exactly right. So let's go down that road a little bit and talk about how do we begin the process of reversal. I think what we're seeing right now is this. First of all, globalization is failing and dying on the vine. Corporatism and international corporatism is being seen as a criminal enterprise rather than a substantively beneficial one. And so what we're starting to see is their own actions have superseded their own greed. In other words, we're watching companies.
I think on the local level, people have to begin to support each other. For example, there have been some terrible things happening in the United States. There are farmers who sell raw milk, and the government has been actually using armed forces to go into these small dairy farms to attack people who are selling raw milk.
Yep.
Well, the communities who live around those people should be appalled at this kind of behavior, and they should stand up to support these people. For example, recently Gibson Guitar was raided because they said they were using illegal wood, but they bought that wood legally, and they weren't violating any kind of international contract. But they were told that if they moved there, they offshored their company, that all of their problems would go away. Well, what kind of Department of Justice do we have that would threaten a company to offshore, that all their problems would go away if they offshore their businesses? I think people are living in a blind world if they don't understand how certain elements of the government are working to destroy the business community that's still viable in the United States.
Yeah. Well, the idea then, I guess, Nancy, is that this failure we're watching take place in real time is actually an opportunity that we have to be able to leverage in order to get the kinds of changes that we need to implement. So as bad as it is going to be for many, and it's including myself, it has to be seen in its light as an opportunity, and we have to start using these opportunities to make the change we need to make.
Well, one of the things that I've been fascinated, I'm sort of watching Mexico, because, you know, people talk about Latin American countries and the corruption, and certainly, I think we in the North cannot talk talk about corruption in other countries anymore, because our corruption is so deep and so international that I think we have to come. We need to be the man in the mirror and look at our own problems. But one of the things they have in Mexico, they call them tianguis, and they're markets. They're moving markets. And people don't pay any taxes there. They pay a fee to the town government to be able to have the stall where they sell things. They're mostly their vegetables, fruits, and other kinds of small household items. And when you go to the tianguis, they don't. It's just a cash business. That's it.
Yeah.
So the town gets a fee for the stall. It's not a big fee, and then people are allowed to have their business. And these small businesses, and you can see the American stores moving in here, the supermarket chains, Costco and Walmart and some of the big stores, Sears and other things are here. But the people still have these tianguis, and the tianguis are able to help keep prices low. And I think we, unfortunately, when the government in the United States is going around shutting down children's lemonade stands, we can see how far away from a freedom of business that we've come. That's not a free enterprise system. In a free enterprise system, there should be very little taxation on a person's ability to create a business and to have an income from that business. And that's what I'm seeing here. I'm seeing more free enterprise than I see in the United States.
Well, let's for our final subject here, talk about a politician that everybody seems to follow and I have zero trust in, a guy named Ron Paul, and I'll tell you why I don't trust this man. First of all, he talks the talk, and he puts all the right bells and whistles in, except the fact that he says anybody who thinks that 9/11 was done by anybody but the Arabs is crazy. And he also says that the reason that they attacked us was because we are in their country, which is another nonsense. The idea that this guy, a signatory to PNAC, by the way, and somebody who was one of he worked with a PNAC guy,
I don't think he's a signatory to PNAC.
Well, he was involved with the people that were. In fact, a guy named Lehman and some others. But here's the other side of it. His last campaign, he raised $30 million. He spent $6 million, kept $24 million. That went into his private coffers, never has reemerged. He didn't spend it on the last election. He was there to hive off people's support and never came forward with anything important. I know as a fact that this guy, if he weren't working for them, in my view, and there's a lot of reasons why I don't trust him. If he weren't working for them, he'd have been shot in the head already. The bottom line is the guy's in his 70s. They'd have just dosed him with some kind of poison and got rid of him. The truth is he is saying some of the right things about the Federal Reserve and some of the right things. He's a foil. And I have been around this stuff long enough to smell a rat. There's a good article on my website about the reasons why people should be suspicious of this guy. But it goes into some very serious detail about his associations in the Reagan administration and after the fact. And about his associations to even drug companies and so forth. So there's stuff there, and he's, of course, a lifelong Republican who's worked with some of the worst of the worst, including Tom DeLay and others. In fact, Tom DeLay's district was just next to his. I've never heard him come out against any corruption that was going on in his party or anything else. So,
the one thing that I do remember, and this is all I can say, is that he made a pretty powerful speech about the neocons when they were getting ready to go into Iraq.
Well, the truth of the matter is that his votes have looked good, but I got to be honest with you, I don't have faith in. Read the article, and it's what I believe, and I'll give you a good example, Nancy. Everybody thinks that Iran, in my view, is working with these people, not against them, and I got to tell you why. There are roots in Iran's foundation through Khomeini, through the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood is run out of London. It's run by the Zionist community, and it is the opposite side of the equation that they always control. This is a situation where they would never allow somebody taking 20-30% of any vote that wasn't already in their control. They would get rid of the person either through threat, through intimidation, or through murder. And the fact is that in the Middle East, we're seeing Gaddafi, and now a lot of people think Gaddafi is working for his countrymen. I'm telling you, he's there as a depopulation tool. As long as Gaddafi can keep fighting with the rebels, and their nation is never going to have a population that ever comes back to normal. We've seen it happen in Iraq. We've seen it happen in Kenya, in the Mau Maus. We saw it happen in South Africa. We've seen it happen in Central America. This is a tried and true system, and basically, I have very little faith that Gaddafi would be alive if he wasn't useful. Neither would Saddam Hussein have been there as long as he was if he wasn't useful. And all of these men have worked behind the scenes with Israelis. The Iran-Contra affair, they were involved with Iran up to their eyeballs while everybody on the surface was calling them the great Satan. The Iranians were doing deals with America through Israel.
Well, I think that people need to remember when Reagan was... the day that he was inaugurated, they kept the American hostages because he and Bush had made a deal with the Iranians behind Carter's back. So that very day, to keep the American hostages, so the very day that Reagan was sworn in, the hostages were let loose.
Exactly.
That goes back to that. But I would like people, so I think that, again, I just recently had been reviewing some information from Anthony Sutton and from Carol Quigley.
Yep.
And from Norman Dodd. And people can find these people. You don't even have, for example, Carol Quigley's book is now in PDF form.
Yeah.
On the internet, you don't have to buy it. And also, these people have videos on YouTube. And I really would challenge people to, especially Anthony Sutton has done some unbelievable research, to begin to understand how at the highest levels this money has worked in order to set up, which is Daryl is talking about right now, how they set up straw men in order to be able to control them.
Well, that's right. And you said it earlier in this interview that we were shipping our technology through men like Armin Hammer. Armin Hammer would take technology in his satchel and go right over to Moscow and turn over computer blueprints. And in fact, if you remember correctly, they had their own space shuttle that looked bizarrely exactly like the one we had built.
Yeah, but it wasn't because Armin Hammer was like the go-between, but GE was involved, Ford was involved, ITC was involved, Caterpillar was involved,
exactly.
The major banking structures were involved, and of course, American taxpayer dollars through the Federal Reserve were being used to finance the whole thing.
That's right. And so this is why I know when I watch something unfold like the confiscation of the Libyan oil assets in their water system, and I see the fact that Safi Gaddafi, I don't know if that's pronounced it right, the son of Muammar Gaddafi, is on Corfu with Nate Rothschild and Mendelsohn having lunch and dinner over there just a couple of years back, and that they intervened for this guy in a French situation, and I mean, the guy has been working in those circles for years, and the simple truth is that you have to understand that the game behind the scenes is not what you think it is, and if you expect this to be a straight up and down situation, black and white, communist, non-communist, that you are really deluding yourself.
Well, it's never straightforward. There are always other motives, and I think for people who just are pretty much what you see is what you get, I think it's very difficult for more straightforward people to understand the level of this treachery.
I agree, Nancy. We've reached the end of our hour, and I want to give you an opportunity to maybe have anything that you'd like to close with here. You know, this wasn't I kind of wing it every time we do a show, and we've often spoken about your book, because it's a tremendous book, and I urge anybody out there who wants an education on our medical system as well as its connections to this crime network called AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire, The Deadly Virus of International Greed, by my friend Nancy Turner Banks, MD. You got to go out and get this book. How are sales of the book, by the way?
I'm amazed because the book is sort of arcane, and I'm amazed at how many people are reading it, enjoying it, and understanding it, and beginning to because the book connects a lot of dots, and that's what I wanted to do. But this is what I want to leave people with. This is what we need to understand. that there's a force that's running amok among us that wants to divorce us from who we are as humans, and that they're using the technology to do this. They're using the healthcare system, they're using the internet, the Wi-Fi, the entertainment industry to divorce us from our higher selves. And we have to be aware of that, and we have to begin to stop being fearful of acknowledging that these are things that are impinging on our freedom to be the best that we can. But more than anything, we have to stop sacrificing our children on the altar of this technology, because what we're doing is that we're dumbing down and we're killing our next generation. And one of the things that should be of a big concern to anybody in the United States, that our infant mortality over the last 10 years has moved from 28th in the world to 40th, and so that our children are truly not in a good state. And if we don't protect our children, we don't have a future.
I agree with all of that, and it's well said, Nancy. You know, ladies and gentlemen, Nancy Turner Banks is somebody that I know a year from now she'll come on this programming. I hope we're still working together and bring up more important issues. This is an ongoing thing. You know, we don't come to the end of a road and say we're done now. This is a process of regenerating who we are as humans and getting us ourselves back to our true selves. This is a process we're going to be going the rest of my life and generations to come. So the best to you, Nancy. I wish you have a nice day over there. I know it's still early enough for you to get other things done. Over here it's winding down and starting already to get a little dark outside, so I'm going to call it a show, and thank you very much.
Have a great day, Daryl. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Daryl Bradford-Smith telling you all, please take care of your families and be well. Bye-bye now.